Let us turn to Acts chapter 25. We'll read the last verse of the previous chapter, chapter 24, verse 27, and then into chapter 25. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul, and besought him, and desired favour against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them therefore, said he, which are among you, are able to go down with me, and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down unto Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. It has been said that great results happen through little things. Or putting it more graphically, large doors turn on small hinges. It's a way of describing how divine providence often works. The Lord can use a very small thing to accomplish a very important end. And this is fascinating to observe. The fact that God works through great things, but that God works through small things as well. Nothing is too small or ordinary for him to take up in his providential working. You have an example here in these verses we have just read. It was the preservation of Paul's life. And you might think that if God is going to move to protect Paul from death, that he would move heaven and earth in some way, or do some great thing. But the fact is, he uses a very small thing that you almost would not have noticed and wouldn't have seen as being God's providence. It has to do with verses 3 and 4, where the Jews at Jerusalem ask the new governor Festus if he will send for Paul from Caesarea, that he might be brought to Jerusalem so that they, the Jews, can have him before their tribunal. And the Romans can be part of it as well, but they would like to have him tried in Jerusalem. But of course the real reason for requesting that is in verse 3. Laying wait in the way to kill him. On his way from Caesarea to Jerusalem, there'll be an ambush and an assassination. And so Paul is in mortal danger. How is it that the Lord works to prevent that happening? In verse 4, but Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither, and says, you Jews, come with me to Caesarea, and we'll hear Paul's case there. So he stays in Caesarea, and this plot is overthrown. Just the word of the governor. And that is the providence of God. Just imagine if it had not been that Paul had been killed. Then the rest of the New Testament wouldn't have been written. There would have been churches not founded. the gospel preached no more to many, many people, it would have been a huge loss. But as it was, the Lord in his providence had its way by the decision of Festus. And dear friends, that small thing is typical of how the Lord works, and he works like that in your life and mine. We can trace obvious providences, too great to miss, but other providences, many more of them probably, we have hardly noticed because they are so small, and yet just as much of God and just as wonderful as the larger ones. We can describe providence as an extension of creation, really. The God who created everything in the beginning is the God who governs and rules everything now, in things great and small. And so providence is when God provides for us within that creation he's made, or when God steers events, overrules things, and works through things, agents, events, people, all sorts of things. It's really an extension of creation. So you see, God is not a God who has just made everything and set it all running, and then he's stepped back from it and left it to its devices. He's a God who is active and at work in his creation ceaselessly, and is governing everything, performing all things for you and me. Gives us a great view of the world and a great view of everything that happens. God is in charge, and the Creator is the sustainer, the governor, the one who is over all in his provision and guidance, his wonderful providence. Well, let's look a little closer then at this event to learn some more of this. And you can see that it turns on those two verses, 3 and 4. And they desired favour against Paul, that he, Festus, would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea. There's the and the but, isn't there? There's the and of the Jews and the but of Festus, or the but of God's providence, really. So let's look at the and of the Jews, first of all. He desired favour. They desired favour against Paul. The Jews have a new provincial governor, Porcius Festus, who replaced Felix in AD 60. Felix just left Paul in custody for 2 years, then quitted his office, and Festus comes in his place, and of course has to take over Paul's case. It's still not resolved. Now, Festus was something of an energetic governor. You see in verse 1, as soon as he was come into the province, after just 3 days, he left Caesarea, the seat of the governor, and he came to Jerusalem. Why? Well, if you're going to govern these Jews, you want to find out all you can about them. And so where better than Jerusalem? And so he's at Jerusalem to discover all he can to prepare him and help him to be their governor, the governor of Judea. Now, history tells us that Festus was more upright and diligent than Felix was. He was only governor for 2 years before he died. How often it is the case with good rulers that they don't last long. It's, well, we know it's all providence. It seems that rotten rulers are there for always, almost, and yet the best men come and they go, and they're sorely missed. Think of King Edward the sixth, for an example. But being energetic, the Jews see their chance. And verse 2, the high priest and the chief of the Jews start slandering Paul to the new governor and ask if he can be brought from Caesarea to this place in Jerusalem. My, they lost no time, did they, in raising Paul's case with the governor. They got there first. Before even Festus would meet Paul, the Jews are there to prejudice his mind against them. 2 years have gone by, and they've not forgotten. They've not let it rest. Raising it again. My. And more than this, they petition him to bring Paul to Jerusalem to be tried there, and desired favour against him, against Paul, to send for him to Jerusalem. Striking while the iron is hot, you see, hoping that they can ambush and assassinate Paul and rid the earth of this man that they hate so much. Now we see in this, don't we, something evidently satanic. And they desired favour. They wanted a favour concerning Paul. They asked for something. They asked that he might be brought from Caesarea to Jerusalem to be tried there, but they know they mean something else. And that's deceitful and malicious. And isn't that just like the devil? He covers his true purpose with something plausible. You think about temptation, for instance. He tempts us to sin and promises that we'll be the gainer thereby. But he knows it will only be loss. Witness Adam and Eve and ever afterwards. You see, something plausible, and yet the real truth is hidden. Deceit and malice. Think of how he accuses us. Do you get accused by the devil in your conscience so that you're made to feel guilty? He accuses God's good people, the best of them. He makes them feel guilt, but he knows that they're innocent. It's plausible. We're very ready to take guilt to ourselves, aren't we? But the devil knows it's false guilt that he's created. But that's how he works, you see. He hides the truth by trading in deceit. Do you get frightened sometimes? Does the devil fill your mind with frightening scenarios? Well, he knows what he's raising in your mind is groundless. It's not going to happen. But it's real to you, isn't it? It's real to me. And we've got to struggle with this kind of apprehension and foreboding. But he's a liar and a deceiver. He makes it seem plausible and real, but underneath it, it's false and it's deceitful. He is a liar and a deceiver. The truth is not in him. John 8, verse 44. The truth is not in him. Why do we believe him then? Why do we believe that sin is a good thing if we yielded to it in a time of temptation? Why do we believe him with feelings of guilt and allowing ourselves to be accused by him when he's a liar? Why do we believe him when there are these frightening thoughts or these things that mildly terrorize us in our feelings and in our hearts? He's a liar and a deceiver. He's no more to be believed than these wicked Jews, who are of their father the devil, and the lusts of their father they will do. But the enemy here, you see, he never gives up. They never give up. You may probably remember that this is the second time they tried that. Do you remember chapter 23? And verse 15, how that 40 of them bound themselves with an oath that they would eat nothing until they had slain Paul. And again, they tried to get him fetched from Caesarea down to Jerusalem, and they were planning to kill him on the way. Well, that failed. Maybe it's the same 40 men. Maybe they had to break their vow or starve to death. But here's a second attempt now 2 years later to try to fulfill the vow. My, what zeal, isn't it? What zeal. If they don't succeed, they'll try and try and try again. Won't let it drop. A second attempt, never forgetting what they've set out to do, and hell-bent, literally, on seeing it through. What zeal! How good it would be, dear friends, if we worked as hard for the good of the Lord's people as these wicked enemies work hard for the harm of the Lord's people. Titus 2 verse 14, zealous of good works. That's what we should be. Don't let the devil's servants put us to shame, doing their foul work, and we do ours so lukewarmly. The difference, of course, is the devil drives, doesn't he? The Lord sweetly leads. We've got an infinitely better master. Let us do his will, gladly and zealously, for the good of the Lord's people in his name, in Christian charity and good works. But what they were doing was satanic. And Paul doesn't realize the danger he's in. There he is in Caesarea, in his house arrest, having some liberty and having visitors, and fairly comfortable, really. Sublimely unaware that his life is in danger. We don't know the half, do we, of what the devil might be trying, what the enemies of the Lord might be plotting. But the Lord knows. And if we're in his way, then everything is in his hands, not in their hands. Providence is over all. Providence is in charge. Providence will have the last word in everything. So the "and" of the Jews, and, trying again and again and never leaving off, never letting it go. Let's look at the "but" of Festus, secondly, verse 4. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and so on. And you can see how God intervened for Paul. Because this "but" is God's "but," isn't it? God's "but," and oh, the "buts" of Scripture. They can be tremendously big words, introducing wonderful works of God. And this one certainly is. And here, a man who is the new governor thinks that he's exercising his authority. No, we'll keep Paul at Caesarea and you can join me and we'll... Sorry, that's right, yes. Keep him at Caesarea and you can come with me and we'll hear his case in Caesarea. He thinks he's asserting his authority over the Jews. But it was only to fulfill God's purpose. And we're told in Proverbs 16 and verse 1. Tremendous truth this. And it's true in every case. People are not their own. They're not robots, but they're not their own. They are free agents, but still under the government of God. Proverbs 16 verse 1. The preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. See how he is the first cause in everything. What people think and what people say as a result, from the Lord. And God put it into the heart of Festus to say no to the Jews. Not Jerusalem, but Caesarea. And that saved Paul's life. Now, it's all the more remarkable that this should be so, because you see, it is obvious that Festus wanted to be known as a good man in the eyes of the Jews. You've got to really, if you're going to rule Jerusalem and Judea as a Roman governor, you've got to have the cooperation of these turbulent people. Any moment there might be an uprising, trouble, riots and so on. And although you've got the might of Rome at your back, it's much better if you can keep the Jews on board. And you notice how Felix, verse 27 of the previous chapter, Acts 24, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. That was a mean thing to do, wasn't it? Just to please the Jews, Felix didn't do anything more about Paul's case for the 2 years. And then he was recalled to Rome and Festus took over. But what do we read about Festus? Look at verse 9 of Acts 25. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure. He was a Jew pleaser as well. He'd gone to Jerusalem to learn about the Jews and get acquainted with things and maybe to court the favour of the Jews. And look, verse 3. They desired favour against Paul. And you would have thought, well, it would greatly enhance Festus' standing to right at the beginning give in to the Jews' request. And let's have Paul fetched from Caesarea to Jerusalem. And the Jews would have been pleased with that. And Festus would have curried favour with them. And that was, in a way, a reasonable request. And yet, Festus says no. Right at the beginning. But it was a golden opportunity to be in with the Jews and make a good start, favourably. But no. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea. Against even his instincts to please the Jews, he says the opposite, because God put it into his heart. And there's another verse in Proverbs. Proverbs 21 and verse 1, which is true in every case as well. Proverbs 21 verse 1, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. Just like a river follows the channel along which it flows, with the two banks, one at either side, so the heart of man follows where God leads it and is under his control. So this butt of Festus is the butt of God. And it is so in every case. The Lord can intervene and make people in charge, people in high places, kings, queens, heads of state, world rulers, do his will, even against what they might humanly otherwise have done. God can turn the hearts of individuals anywhere. Even our enemy, perhaps. Even someone who's got it in for us. God can turn their heart, change their attitude toward us, turn them from an enemy into a friend, an opposer into a supporter, someone who's against us into someone who's for us. The Lord can melt hearts, change hearts. Remarkable how he... Well, it's not remarkable. Of course, every heart is in his hand. The world is in his hand. And the universe as well. But even in little things, this little thing, Festus' decision made at that time. And we can commit things to God and look to him and pray to him that he will work like this. An additional thing here, of course, is that there is a promise that lay behind all this. In chapter 23, in verse 11, and the Lord stood by Paul, be of good cheer, Paul, as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Paul has got to go to Rome. That's where it's all going to end up, isn't it? Well, then he can't be killed, can he? On the road from Caesarea to Jerusalem. And that makes him immortal. Invincible. God has promised that Paul will be there to witness for him at Rome. And nothing that the Jews can do can change it. Nothing that the devil might try can change it. When God is committed to you and to me by his faithfulness and his good promises, we are safe and we will be blessed. Now the devil knew this. The devil knew about this promise, and yet he tries to overthrow it. He tries to have Paul killed through these Jews. And of course he signally failed. You think, wouldn't you, that he would have learnt by now that it's impossible to resist God. You can't overthrow what God has purposed to do. And even though he knows that it's futile, he still does it. Why is that? Because he's such an implacable enemy against God and his people that there's an irrationality about the devil. He does it because he will do it, knowing full well he's going to fail every time. Or even if it appears a success, it's only a temporary success. The triumphing of the wicked is short and God overrules it and takes it up into his larger purposes. But the devil always fails. One preacher said once that when the devil's head was bruised by Christ's triumph on the cross, it left him with brain damage, because he's always trying what he knows will not succeed, and yet he's still trying it, as if he can't seem to get his head round the fact that he is defeated and will be defeated, and God is always above him. I don't mean to be facetious, but it's a rather colourful way of putting it, and maybe there's some truth in it. Thank God that his power is broken, his intelligence is broken in a sense, even though he's so very cunning and so very clever. But he doesn't seem to learn that he can never win and he can never ultimately prevail. And any seeming success is temporary. God's promises, God's faithfulness, God's covenant mercies are always toward us, and guarantee the devil will fail. And so God keeps his promise. Like John Flavel said, grace makes the promise and providence the payment. How many promises lie behind the Lord's dealings with us? All there in the Word. And even if we've not read them and pleaded them, God will be true to them. Because this is our charter. The charter of our salvation and of our protection and our blessedness while we are in this world. And God will fulfill his covenant promises. And God will overrule. We don't know how many Festuses have been made to say or do things in our favour that have defeated the devil. But God is ceaselessly at work. Now this is where it comes to the fascination, really. It is a very human explanation here, isn't there? That verse 4, Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart thither, and invited these Jews to join him to try his case in Caesarea. Now on the face of it, that is very ordinary, because Paul is a Roman citizen. And Roman citizens shouldn't have their cases tried at Jerusalem, where the Jews' seat of authority is, the Sanhedrin and council and so on. Roman citizens should have their cases tried at Caesarea, where the governor has his seat of authority. And ultimately, of course, at Rome, which Paul appeals to eventually, doesn't he? And he has his case heard there. And so you would have said, well, it was obvious that Festus would say that. And in a sense it is. But that's how God worked in providence. It doesn't look like providence, does it? It just looks like a Roman governor doing his thing. Just looks as if it's a good thing that Paul is a Roman citizen, and that his privilege gives him some protection. And that Festus says, no, we'll have his case heard at Caesarea if you Jews don't mind, and you can join me there. And there is the fact that God's providence operates through human and logical means so that you hardly realize it is happening. It's a marvelous thing that God can work invisibly, and it can seem as if he's not working. And there are not labels that pop up. There aren't things that flag up and say, this is providence, this is providence, this is providence, like that. There are no markers. But faith believes that even when a thing is looking as purely human as it can look, God is in it. What is there that happens where God is not? Because he is in everything. And that's what makes it so exciting, is it? You never know where God is working, through whom, what event. Even the smallest and most ordinary of things, you can believe that God is there. And that's why we look for these things, don't we? In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. You want to visit someone in hospital, and the wretched car park is chock-a-block with cars, and how are you going to park your car and get to the ward on time? And just as you go in the entrance, someone pulls out so conveniently, having finished their visit. How do you explain that? Well, the Lord is in it. That's not being pious or silly. And you say in your heart, Lord, I thank thee for that provision. Because you see God in everything. Whatever. Things great or small. You never know what God is doing, where he is. All can be put down to this and interpreted accordingly, so that really at the end of the day there's nothing purely human. People are not in charge. The devil's not in charge. The Lord is in everything. Do you keep your eyes open, the eyes of faith, and look for the Lord in little things and thank him for them again and again in everything? It's the most blessed thing. That's godliness, isn't it? That's piety. True religion. That's the Lord in everything. So, dear friends, there's an invisible hand guiding all events, great and small. And what we want to be is in his way, like Paul was in his way. We don't want to be outside of the centre of his will. As far as we know, examining our hearts and watching over ourselves, we want to be in that place where we feel and believe that we're doing what's right, we're walking with God, we're keeping his way, and then all is well. And we can do what we read in Psalm 37 verse 5. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. If things are perplexing at the moment for you, circumstances adverse, people perverse and troublesome, things happening, believe that God is in it. He has the hearts of all men under his control. Commit your way to him. Pray that he'll have his way. Resolve matters as best is for his glory and your good. Because he cares for us all the way to heaven. The Lord takes pleasure in his people. Paul was a jewel in a heap of lumber in Caesarea. Precious, sparkling jewel. And the Lord counted him precious. And so are you. And so am I. And all is subject to the but of divine intervention. They may be the and of the devil and his servants, but there is the but of God and his instruments. Let us be subject to that all our lives long for the glory of his name. Let us sing together now hymn 81.